history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty incredible stories in your neighborhood if you take the time to listen to members of our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do so, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and a lot of times inspired by these stories. Sometimes we're just downright amazed. It's just hard to believe some of the coincidences we come across. And we're definitely coming across one of those here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, at the Military Museum with over 100 military vehicles. I guess if you're going to find a vehicle you drove in World War II, you come to a military museum with vehicles. But we're going to hear the story of how this unfolded from 91-year-old Tom Grasser of Albuquerque, New Mexico, but originally from Kenosha, Wisconsin.
That's correct.
What was it like growing up in Kenosha, Wisconsin in the 30s and 40s?
I tell you, I was more fortunate than most. My dad had a job during the Depression. Those were tough times for a lot of people, and God bless them. We came out of them. I lived right on Lake Michigan. In fact, our home was just on the backwaters of the harbor. They always used to say we could probably swim before we could walk.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of the way it was. Anyhow, we had a good life. Don't ever realize that it was as tough for my parents to keep us going. We took it for granted. Of course, didn't have the cell phones and all that the kiddos have now, but used to play outside a lot, which was nice. We had patched up clothes, but they're clean. I went to school in a Catholic school, and of course, not I'm not going to say mean, but they were kind of tough. They're tough girls, but they're wonderful, and they gave us a good education. And for that, I'm very thankful. I've been very blessed.
Well, when you mention that, I guess the question I have to ask to really get a sense and perspective when you talk about the nuns being tough, I mean, you were in the Army in World War II. Who was tougher, the nuns or the drill sergeants?
I think the nuns were.
I had a feeling you might say that. And I can tell you're from Wisconsin because you're wearing a Brett Favre Packers wristwatch. You don't find those too many places in Albuquerque. Do you remember, I know it's a long time ago, but as a boy, before World War II, do you remember what kind of dreams or ambitions, ideas you had about your future?
Gee whiz, that's a tough one. Going to Catholic school, all us boys thought we were going to be priests. But you got to be pretty intelligent to get a job like that. And I wasn't the smartest kid in the class. In fact, until I got to fourth grade, I didn't realize I couldn't see.
Really?
We used to go to Mass every morning in a Catholic school in those days. That was the first order of the day. The candles on the altar would look like big fuzzballs to me.
Huh.
And finally, in the fourth grade, the nun said, Tom, I don't think you can see. And, I didn't know. And sure enough, they went and had my eyes checked, and I didn't need glasses. Going to Mass, and after I got my glasses, I could see the wick, and the candle, the flame. And I looked down the road, and I could see signs and things that were just blurred.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a little better in school after that.
I suppose so, and it makes a big difference, although it probably did ruin your future as a football referee. I mean, that was probably out the window.
Gone. It was gone.
One question I like to ask every veteran, because it seems like everybody who was alive then has a specific memory about this day. December 7th, 1941. You remember that day?
Yeah.
You remember how you found out?
Yeah, I was sitting in the balcony of the Orpheum Theater in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I had a little girlfriend, and we were actually necking in the balcony. And, of course, came this. Mm. And we could not believe it. The time was early afternoon, I guess it was, on a Sunday. Going into service or something, I was never on, didn't even consider it.
Mm-hmm.
They'd finished World War I just, a few years before.
Yeah.
And for us to be going to war again, I could not believe it. I was in the theater. I don't remember the movie that was played, but I do remember where I was.
Well, and after your description, we know why you don't remember the movie that was played.
What can I say?
Was there an immediate desire to do something about it, to get involved in the service, or did that take a while?
I tell you, patriotism in the United States at that time, and especially right after that, was unbelievable. Everybody got behind the war effort. Women, they used to have a job as teachers and secretaries and nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of them were pretty well housekeepers. When the war came along and all the men went into service, a lot of them that were old enough, these ladies jumped in, and God bless them. If it wasn't for them, we couldn't have done the job that we were able to do. The farmers, Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, had scrap drives. It's unbelievable, the patriotism, and I'm sure we still got it. Everybody was behind us. Mm-hmm. In the States. And to get to it, back to what you asked, I thought I'd go in the Navy. I figured that'd be a good, clean place and be able to do something. So I was a junior in high school, went to join up for the Navy, and I wore glasses. And they said, well, we won't take you because you wear glasses. He says, but the Army will take you. I said, well, they're going to have to draft me. And so I finished out my high school graduation anyhow, ended up not at the head of the class, but we got out June the 11th, 1943. June the 17th, we were sworn in the Army.
Wow.
And we had a week, well, until the 1st of July, to get our house in order. Got on a train in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and of course they took us out to Fort Ord, California.
Mm-hmm.
Told us that we're going to be ambulance drivers. I didn't know how to drive. My mother had been killed in an automobile accident when I was 11.
Mm.
My dad never drove again.
Wow.
And I tore up, I'm sure, a transmission or two trying to learn how to drive an ambulance. But they got the job done. And I always tell a story, and nobody's older than me, so they can't dispute it. But we trained in the Redwood Forest and also in Big Sur out in California. And I said, there's probably still some marks on those Redwood Forest trees that I did with my bumper on, in the ambulance.
I thought you were going to tell me the one with the hole through the trunk. You put it there.
Well, but no, that one was done already. Otherwise, uh-huh, I'd have given it a good shot.
I got to ask you in all seriousness, because as you described that, that's your life history, your mother dying when you're 11 and your father not driving again. But was it emotionally difficult for you to take that on because that had been such a weighty issue in your family?
I'll tell you a little funny story. I don't know why me, but I used to make the oatmeal. We always had oatmeal to go to school. The kids would have it.
Mm-hmm.
And I stood on a stool and made oatmeal. Sometimes it'd be running, sometimes it'd be chunky, but by golly, they got out of the house with a warm tummy anyhow. And we had 8 children. I remember we had one bathroom, and one of the kids would wash in the sink. The other one would be in a tub washing, and then we had a little dresser with towels and washcloths in, and we had a pan on there that we'd wash in there. So 3 of them going at one time, and they moved them out. I came from a German family, and, you know, snap, snap, snap.
Yeah, the assembly line going.
You got it.
Yeah. You had 7 siblings, is what you're saying.
That's correct.
How many of you ended up in the service?
I'm going to go back a little bit when my mom had the baby. In those days, a lady would be in bed for maybe, I don't know, I'm going to lie to you now, but 5 or 6 weeks or
sure.
While we'd have a housekeeper would come in and cook for us and clean house and get us off, you know, and all. And Mrs. Hansen was a lady that had been there for the baby, and my dad went and talked to her. She had a good job. She had a little old lady she was cooking for and 2 bachelor sons that were growing. Mrs. Reichert's lived on 5th Avenue in Kenosha. My dad went down there, and she told Mrs. Hansen, George Grasher's got a house full of kiddos. He needs you. We hate to see you go, but you better go with him. And that's the way it was.
Hmm.
And, of course, after a year, she became my mom. And I, one thing, women have always played a good part in my life. I tell you, they've been good to me. And I had a wonderful mother and a wonderful stepmother. And I hate to use the word step, but she was a real lady and a love. And, of course, they used to call me a brown noser because I tried to please her all the time. But I was so pleased, and I was smart enough at the time to know that. We were blessed to have her. It ended up why, to answer your question, there's three from our original family went in, and two from her family.
Wow.
So we had five of us in there.
And y'all came home?
Yeah. Three of us went overseas. My oldest brother, or stepbrother, was a Marine, and he went to the Pacific. My other brother, stepbrother, went in the Air Force. I was going to say Corps. That's what we called it at that time.
Yep.
He stayed stateside. And, of course, my brother George, the oldest one of the Grassers, was OMP. And
okay.
They had a prisoner of war camp over in Racine, which is right next door to Kenosha. And he was a guard there. I went in the medical corps and drove ambulance and came home on our vacation before we went overseas. And my older brother Dick was frozen on his job. He worked for McWhite Wire and Rope, and it was a war job. So he was frozen on his job. And when I came home just before we went overseas, went back, told his boss, he says, my kid brother's going overseas. And he says, I'm in better shape than him, and also I got to go. So Dick went and signed up, was in the 35th Division. He went overseas. He was a forward scout, and he got hit pretty bad with shrapnel in his back and arm. Pardon me.
Sure.
He lost his right arm.
Wow.
And pretty well tore up. But my oldest brother, stepbrother, he got shot in the legs over in the Pacific. I was told that they had wooden bullets, and they'd hit, and then they'd splinter.
Right.
And so his legs were pretty well shot up. I did get a scratch.
But you saw a lot of guys who did. And I've got to follow up on that with your brother Dick. Sounds like you're saying he didn't have to go. He had an exemption with his job. And the only reason he went, because you were going, and he felt bad for not going if you were going.
That's it. That's
and then
it.
He gets hit.
Yep.
Yeah. And probably pretty close to where you were if he was in the 35th Infantry Division.
Actually, I found out where he was. I told my CO, well, not CO, my platoon leader, I said, my brother Dixon was in the 7th Army Hospital. And he says, he's at such and such a place. And right now, I can't even tell you where it was. And I said, I'd like to take a load over there. And he said, by all means. When I got there, a fellow, Richard Schultz, lived across the street from us in Kenosha, was a company clerk for this hospital. Went to see him, and he said, they flew him out yesterday.
Oh.
Just missed him. I said, well, how was he? He says, well, he's doing fine. And first time that it ever soaked in on me that he was hit kind of bad. He says, I don't think he's going to lose his arm. And he did, but I did not know that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We had so many that, you know, it'd be little wounds, big wounds, you know, all kinds of stuff. And it just never crossed my mind.
Mm.
But, yeah, he was a good guy.
And we haven't even scratched the surface of your story yet, but it occurs to me that if there's anybody who really understands the price of freedom with your family and what you witnessed, you're probably that guy.
Well, I'm a rich man. just honestly didn't think, I don't think anyone thought they'd come back.
What were you thinking when you went over? Because you're just a teenager, right?
Yeah. It was a job we had to do, and of course, we had such good backing from all the people back here. It was the thing you did. There was no question about it. You were going to do what you could. Every one of these people went over, they did what they were trained to do, and they did a good job.
Mm-hmm.
We really had esprit de corps for the U.S. We were proud of our country, and we had every right to be because we're a good country then, and we're still a good country.
And Mr. Grasser picked a good spot to settle after the war. If he hadn't ended up in New Mexico, an incredible reunion likely wouldn't have unfolded more than 7 decades later. We're going to hear about that, about the work he did as an ambulance driver overseas, and what it was like for this young man, not even 21 years old, to come face-to-face with the tragedy of not one, but two Nazi concentration camps. Check out photos and video of Mr. Grasser on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 91-year-old Tom Grasser of Albuquerque, New Mexico, originally from Kenosha, Wisconsin. We heard him share that he lost his mother in a car accident as a young boy and that he had never learned to drive until the Army made him an ambulance driver. You're not going to believe the incredible coincidence with his ambulance. Check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. But let's hear now about his first real taste of the war when he landed in France.
We came in on the Omaha Beach. Of course, we had to waterproof our ambulances. We put tape on the door so water wouldn't come in. And the carburetor and differential, they had a gauze material that was had beeswax or something on it. This was to keep the water from getting into the carburetor because you come off an LST and you're in the water.
Right.
And I don't know much about mechanics, but we did cover the carburetor and the distributor and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
Anyhow, landing craft came in. It hit the beach at LST. The doors had opened, and then the ramp went down. And the engineers had been there long enough by the time we went over there that they'd put grates under it. So you come off with your front wheels digging, well, right. You go right in and you couldn't get traction. Anyhow, they were able to beach them high enough and get in there. And it was like a big balloon floating coming in until we got on terra firma. We're in a field. They said, park your cars, their vehicles over there. And they said, it hasn't been checked for landmines yet. So a lieutenant of the 1st Platoon got in a truck, and he drove across the field one way, then the other way, and then angled. And, of course, fortunately, there's no landmine, so we pulled all in there. And then when they got a convoy to go to the front. And that evening, while we were heading out, and we got to Avranches, and apparently there was a bridge there. The vehicles were all backed up, and it got dark. And airplane comes over and drops a flare, several flares. And, of course, I sit on the bumper, a dumb kid, bumper of the ambulance, and said to my buddy, I said, hey, they're taking pictures of us. All of a sudden, 2 Stukas, and they had a whistle on the tail, a screamer, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd come, and I'd make the hair in the back of your head stand up. And anyhow, they came screaming along, and they're bombing and strafing. And Boy Scouts honor, they came to those 30 ambulances that were bumper to bumper. They pulled up, did not drop a bomb or strafe, and then continued strafing. Came around, did it again. And that was when the Germans respected the Red Cross. If it wasn't for that, several of us have been gone the first night on. And funny thing, we went to a bivouac area, and the next morning a guy comes shooting up in a Jeep, and he says, I'm a priest, I'm going to say Mass. Anyone here serve? And, of course, I was able to serve Mass. First day I was on the continent, on the hood of a Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
And figured I had me a good guardian angel. And to this day, and I'm going to give you one. I got guardian angel for you. I'm not the best. I'm no angel by no manner of means. And I'm not the best Christian in the world. But I've got angels that have saved my butt. And who'd ever thought that? Mm-hmm. I hit 91 years of age. I'm a very rich man.
And going strong. I've got to ask you, that circumstance, and again, thinking about how young you are, I mean, you're probably approaching at that point your 20th birthday.
It's yes.
it's 1944, and this is your first taste of combat, and these dive bombers come in, and they're hitting everything around you, and they pause because of the Red Cross. Does that tell you, man, I'm really lucky to still be here, or does it say, uh-oh, I'm going to be in danger the rest of the time I'm over here?
No, I that's going back. That's a long way. But I felt that they respected it. I later found out that as we followed the 4th and the 5th Armored most of the time over there, found out that we carried more Germans back to our hospitals than we did GIs. Hmm. And when we hit the bulge and places like that, we were bringing back GIs. And then we knew we were taking it in the shorts.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the reason they have guys that don't fire guns and they are medics or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
They kept us alive for some reason, and it paid off for a lot of German people who were saved as well.
Well, and that's an important distinction for people to hear, that when you're over there and you've got that Red Cross on the side of your ambulance and probably on the side of your helmet too, that even though you're wearing the colors of the United States, a life is a life.
Yep.
Was it any different for you when you were caring for a wounded enemy soldier?
No, not really. You know, those guys, I think, and that's just my opinion, they're fighting for their country just like we were. The politics they had over there may not have been right, you know, but they're trying to get home to their families, and they're fighting for the country. And I tell you, the hardest thing that bothers me. When we came to Dachau, they thought we were a bunch of Germans in GI uniforms. And the gates, of course, all the guards taken off, and they had to go through the gates with the tanks. And, of course, then we came through in our turn. And a lot of the people had been killed, but a lot of them were still standing there. You know, they just couldn't kill them all or didn't. And for that reason why, I'm real proud that I was a medic. Because we did some good. Some good came out of a bad situation.
And I realize chronologically we're probably going to be bouncing around here a little bit, but since we're on the topic of Dachau, can you help us understand what you saw there? Because so few people in the history of the world actually witnessed that in person, and there are people that say it never happened. But you were there, you saw the people, you saw the shape they were in. What did you see?
I tell you, there were sheds on the side of the with bodies in that were just stacked high. They put, I guess, lye or whatever it was on them. But the people, you could see their joints had been starved, and it was just like so much cordwood piled up. And to see the conditions that they lived under, they were like in barns, and they had shelves with straw on. The people that we took out of there, prisoners that, you know, they just didn't kill them all.
And you witnessed similar things at the Buchenwald concentration camp.
They had big trenches that they dig with bulldozers, and they'd machine gun them there or put them through the ovens. I can't tell you exactly everything, but it's if I live to be 100 years old, that is the worst memory that I have. And to think another person would do this, it's unbelievable. And somebody says it didn't happen. By God, it did. It's just...
I think we all understand why it can make you emotional. And the bottom line is it would have happened to millions more if you guys weren't there to put an end to it. If America didn't stand up the way it did. Did that give you some satisfaction to know that you were part of saving the people who didn't have to suffer that fate?
You know, it does, and still does. The history, I'm not a historian or anything, but people that will say things like that didn't happen. Unfortunately, there are not a lot of us left, but it's going on every day, mm-hmm. even to this day. Mm-hmm. And we figured that was the war to end all wars. It didn't stop a thing, hardly. I don't know. I'm no authority. But I tell you, war is, pardon the expression, is hell. Your sons and daughters and your mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles that were in that thing gave a lot, and they need to be remembered and prayed for. And just, we can never thank them enough.
Amen. Well, you just hammered home exactly why this program exists, and I hope that's what we're doing today. And I don't want to make you dwell on the concentration camp issue, but I do have one question. Because as you go in there and you're part of this liberating force and you're evacuating people who've been emaciated, who've been tortured, who were very near death, had you had any idea before that that these places existed, or was this a complete shock to your system?
Complete shock. We had no idea. We didn't see the news or anything. You know, we were just doing what we, you know, going along. And to run into that was, like I say, it's just indelibly marked in my memory. The worst thing of the whole war was to see what they did to people that were completely helpless, could not defend themselves.
Mm-hmm. On the day-to-day, as an ambulance driver, I mean, on one hand, as I try to imagine being in your shoes, in a war that's claiming so many lives, you get to be a part of saving lives. But at the same time, you probably came face-to-face with a lot of guys you could do nothing for.
Yeah.
What was it like on a day-to-day basis, and what kind of kept you going?
It's a tough one. I think the thinking, and I'm only speaking for myself, was that this was something that we did not start. We were trying to stop it. Every day it becomes routine. You may not like it, but it's what it is. Do your job the best you can. We felt we were right and we were doing the right thing. After it's all over, I know we're doing the right thing. But you get just so that you're not accustomed to it, but it is what it is, and it isn't going to change.
You told us about that first night and the Stukas coming in and how close of a call that was. We can all feel that. I imagine that wasn't the only time, though, that you look back and you feel like one of those guardian angels was there with you.
Yeah. I tell you, looking at this Jeep in front of us right here.
Yeah.
When we went in there, they used to drive with the windshield down and open like that. And they used to string piano wire between the trees. They'd cut a person's head off just. So what we did, the motor pool would have angle iron that would come up high enough to over your head. And then they had a hook hanging down, another piece of angle iron. So if you hit the piano wire, it'd cut it. And one time, Earl was driving and I was just sitting there. It was night and we were trying to get back to where we were supposed to be. And we heard a poing. We hit a piano wire. And I said, Johnson, I don't think we're supposed to be here. We turned around and we barreled out of there. And I do believe that a lot of the soldiers did not shoot at the ambulances or Red Cross. I think they respected it. I could be wrong.
I've talked to a lot of guys, and my grandfather was actually in the Medical Corps in Europe.
He was
at the Bulge, and he had an incident where he got the Silver Star, and he kept going in and pulling guys out, pulled 26 guys out of burning tanks, and they told him afterwards that they weren't shooting at him because of the Red Cross. He wasn't quite sure he believed it. But I've had some other people that were actually targeted at different times, especially in infantry situations. Some of the medics were targeted. So it wasn't always a fail-safe, but it helped you get through.
Yeah. I tell you, early in the war, they used to take the clothes off the guys when they, you know, put them in to work on them and patch them up and all. And there was just piled clothes outside the tent and helmets and, you know, whatever, pistol belts and all. And this one helmet had a Red Cross on it. And we used to have circles on it.
Right, yeah.
Around. And it was right through the middle of the doggone. And that guy blew his head off, I'm sure. We took our Red Crosses off of the helmets.
That was a pretty good warning you got by seeing that. Wow.
Now, whether everybody did it or not, I don't know. But we did.
I don't blame you. I know this isn't easy to talk about, but I'm sure there were scores of wounded soldiers that you dealt with. Some who made it, some who didn't, different degrees of injuries. Not to be gory, but just so we understand, can you give us a sense of the kind of shape that you saw people in and how difficult that was to see them dealing with it?
We had two hospitals there that were side by side, small ones, what they called a field hospital. And the regular evac hospital was where they did the sewing up and sending them. The field hospital was where the people who'd come out of there that had head wounds or gut wounds could not be moved out, and they'd keep them there. When they broke camp to move on to the next place, if there were any people in there that couldn't be evacuated, one ambulance would stay behind. And I remember in Pearl, Luxembourg, our ambulance was chosen to stay behind. And I think we were there for about a week after the other guys had moved out. The people in the little farm village, just one winding road through, farmers, the lady had us up in the attic of the house. And every night we had, if you can believe it, downed comforters. And they made, our beds were up there. We had, you know, sleeping bags. Well, we didn't need to use them there. And she'd come up at night, and they'd had a little water. It looked like the old lunch boxes we used to have when we were kids, kind of a hole in the top, and they'd fill it with water. And they put it on the stove or by the fireplace, and she'd move it around in the bed. When we came back at night, we had a warm bed to sleep in. But we were staying behind because they had two guys that could not be moved. It would have killed them. They were always attached to the evac hospital, and they called it a field hospital.
And was there ever anything, I don't know, maybe there's nothing you can do, but besides the medical care and bandaging guys up and making sure they have all that, and you have a team of people that are working on that, was there ever any emotional or even conversational comfort that you could help provide for any of these guys? Did you ever find a way to help console them?
No, we didn't do that. We just brought them in and dropped them off, and then we'd go back because we figured we'd get back, we'd be able to get some sleep. Well, if it was in a bad time, where we'd turn around. One guy'd drive and one guy'd sleep. And I remember at the evac hospitals, they had a little tent on the side where we could get, they had bread and coffee and the Spam. And people say that they got sick of Spam in World War II. It's the best steak I ever had. We used to cut off chunks real like that. It was a big long tube about that big and just whack it off, put it in between two slices of bread. And we had pockets on there. Fatigues. Fill them up with that, get a canteen full of coffee, and take off. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, that was one of the things that I remember to this day I still love.
It's all about perspective, right? Tom Grasser is our guest today, and the best is yet to come. Don't forget to take a look at the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You're also going to find video of Tom with the old friend he hadn't seen in more than 70 years. It's not a person, but it does have a name, and he'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV. It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you've ever been to Albuquerque, New Mexico, you've probably had a lot of red and green chili, like I do when I go there. And maybe you visited the historic Old Town. Maybe even chatted up some of the volunteers at the information booth there. And if so, maybe you've talked to the gentleman we've been spending this hour with, Tom Grasser, originally from Kenosha, Wisconsin. He served with the 593rd Motor Ambulance Company, part of Patton's Third Army in Europe during World War II. Battle of the Bulge. How did you experience that? How can you help someone who wasn't there understand how brutal both the weather and the fighting were there?
It was a terrible, terrible winter. Fortunately, in the ambulance, we used to have a heater, but you'd be in mud up to your, when it rained, and in snow. Mm-hmm. And it seemed we were cold all the time until we get in the ambulance and we get that thing, and it'd heat up the whole darn ambulance. It seemed like we're cornered and couldn't get out.
And you did feel and experience the uptick in casualties, I'm sure. You're probably a lot busier.
They said, okay, everybody's in the infantry now. Cooks, motor pool, and us medics never carried any weapons. Mm-hmm. We had to qualify, you know, in basic training and all. We never carried any weapons. But they said, we're surrounded, and everybody pick up a rifle. Of course, we were so busy driving that we never had to. Mm-hmm. But that was the word. We're all in the infantry now.
What would you say was the most challenging or difficult part of your time in the service?
The thought that you'd never see your 21st birthday, I think, was probably uppermost in most of the people's. And to this day, something to that effect comes up. We never thought, I knew my dad was going to be a millionaire, because if I got knocked off and I knew I was going to be, he'd get $10,000. $10,000 back then was a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And I figured he'd never have to turn a lick in his life. But that's been a long time ago. I've forgotten an awful lot.
Well, I know one thing you remember is the story of the Dipsy Doodle. Now, you know, we've talked to tons of bomber pilots and guys on their crews, and there's some great stories about how they named a plane and how the decorative nose art came about. I haven't talked to too many guys who named their ambulances, but you guys did. And there's a good story here. It had a name before the Dipsy Doodle. Tell me that story of how that came about.
Well, when we got over to England, I don't know why we were allowed to put a name on our vehicles, but we were all 18 or 19, and the old men of the outfit were 28 or 29. Everything in between had been taken beforehand. Anyhow, all the drivers were usually 28 years old or 29 or older. Us kids were all the assistant drivers. So the driver put the name on the vehicle. Anyhow, my driver, Curly Johnson, his wife was named Flossie. So he had put on the ambulance Flossie Flirt in honor of his wife. Well, after a few months, apparently Flossie ran off with his boss. So Flossie Flirt came off the door, and he said, Tom, he said, you name it this time. At the time, song Dipsy Doodle, I liked it. It was a good one. And I knew all the words then. I said, I'd like to name it Dipsy Doodle. And, of course, we had to send the name off, and I painted Dipsy Doodle on it, and I tipped the letters on it. That's how it got its name. And that's my one claim to glory, I guess.
And you drove that ambulance for the rest of your time over there?
Yep. When the war was finally over, of course, we were on the end of Lake Starnberg. In Germany. We were responsible for delivering, helping the people in the town, you know, our ambulance and all, and we'd take them to the doctors and stuff, or they'd come over to our place. We're just sitting there doing driving. And I always said, I hope the heck none of these ladies have a baby, because I'd hate to have to do that. We'd been told somewhat what to do, but I wasn't high on my things that I wanted to do. Anyhow, that was good duty. But then when we got enough points to go home, they're peeling the guys off. We left the fact is they left before we did, because they had more points. They'd been on the line longer than I had, I guess.
You said goodbye to the Dipsy Doodle. You actually drove it onto a ship?
No, we drove it into what they call a graveyard. And it's a graveyard of vehicles was what it was. And there were Jeeps there and staff cars and trucks and 2.5-ton trucks and tanks and ambulances and kind of trailers that, you know, we pulled in all. We pull in there and just park it next to the, you know, and a bus had come up, pick us up, got on the bus and took us to the boat, and we came home. And that was 71 years ago.
And I've got to ask you, and I know that was 71 years ago, so it's hard to remember, but was it meaningful to you? Was it emotional for you to get home, to see America again? Because you told us you didn't think you were coming back.
No, and I tell you, at the time, they said, you young guys, stay in here and you can be in the Army of Occupation. And I remember telling them, this is one thing I'll never forget. If I get across that pond, I'm the hell out of here. And that's exactly the way it was.
And then you're home, and then you find out about your stepbrother wounded in the Pacific, your brother Dick losing an arm.
Yeah.
Was it hard to deal with all that, or was there just elation because it was over and your side won?
Yes. You know, I'd seen enough of that stuff that I know it was going to happen, and I was surprised that one of us didn't get killed. And we all came home, and that was, we were very, very pleased. My two brothers are pretty ornery. They wouldn't take any help. My God, they're back, and they had it made, and that meant an awful lot, kind of. Give you a shot in the arm.
So you said it was 71 years ago when you drove the Dipsy Doodle, this World War II ambulance, into the vehicle graveyard. I'm sure you never expected to see again. Maybe at that point you didn't care if you saw it again.
I really didn't.
Had it even been a thought in your mind over these 70 years that that vehicle might still be out there somewhere?
No, I truly thought that with all those vehicles there, sure, you know, some would be taken for farm vehicles and all. I figured it'd either been cut up and scrapped and, you know, recycled, or it rotted into the ground, and I really didn't care. But to see that, it just don't happen for someone to see a vehicle. Well, it's a part of me that I never expected to see. Who'd have thought it?
Well, and we're sitting here doing this interview right now in the New Mexico Museum of Military History. They've got over 100 military vehicles. By the way, when did you move to Albuquerque?
Actually, I came to Albuquerque in 1949, worked in the factory, Simmons Company, when I first came out of service, working in the mattress department. Anyhow, I worked in it for a while, and I thought, you know, you got to go back to school and get something. And so I decided to go back to, and it was the school, vocational school at the time. And so I went back, and I took bath and drafting, and then I went back to Simmons Company after I'd gotten out of my training, and went to the engineering department as a draftsman. We'd go around the plant and measure stuff, and they're making mattresses. And at the time, Simmons Company was making rooms on boats, and they'd have the perimeter of the room, and we'd fix beds or bunks, whatever, in there, and tables and what have you. And that's we drew up all that stuff. It was a good job, but I finally decided I was going to be a commercial artist. I'd get art and make some big money. And I went to the VA, and they said, well, best art institute in the world is Chicago. It's just 55 miles north of here. And I said, now, why would I go to school in Chicago? I said, I go there on weekends and get drunk. I sure as heck not going to go to school there. And what we had was two electric lines that would get you right up on the L right in Chicago in an hour. So I said, I want to go somewhere that I haven't been. I wrote to the Chamber of Commerce in Los Angeles, Denver, Colorado, Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Phoenix, Arizona.
All right.
All the states out here, because I'd never been, well, we came through on the train going to California, but
sure,
never been here. Santa Fe, New Mexico, had 35,000 people. They had a Hill and Canyon School of Art, 1005 Canyon Road, took 25 students. That's where I want to go. And I came out here and went to art school and enjoyed it. It was really neat. But my artistic ability was zilch. So I was a pretty good critic, but I wasn't an artist. Anyhow, met a little Spanish gal from Española, New Mexico. Met her in June, married her in October.
Nice work. And you've been in New Mexico ever since?
I've been in New Mexico ever since.
And how did you find out about Nat Holzer's New Mexico Museum of Military History and that they might have an ambulance out here?
Well, a friend of mine at church, John Matternock, he said, Tom, they got an ambulance, a World War II ambulance out at the museum. And he said, I know you drove one. I'd like to take your picture. So what I did is I came out with John, and we walked around the front of it, and I looked at the bumper, and I asked Harry. I said, Harry, I said, where'd you get these numbers? And he says, well, most of them been painted over. And what we do is lightly sand them, try to get the original numbers. 593, 3rd Army, number 14. I said, I drove that thing in World War II for 2 years. And I said, 71 years ago, we parked it in the parking lot and left. And he says, you're kidding me. I said, no, if that's the way you got the number, that was my home on wheels. Who'd have thought? I don't think anybody I've ever heard of would ever run into their old airplane or whatever.
What are the odds? The kid from Wisconsin goes to Europe, drives an ambulance, ends up in Albuquerque. There's the same ambulance. Did you get some goosebumps? Did you pass out? What happened?
I didn't pass out, but I sure got the goosebumps. And the old hair on me, just the few I got, stood up. And I tell you, it was quite a thrill. I was speechless, I think, you know. I just could not believe it. And I still don't. It's hard to believe.
If you climb in that front seat and sit there, close your eyes, what do you see?
I've done that, and I see France and England, Luxembourg, Czechoslovakia. I remember we had to double clutch those things when I learned to drive. They tell me now it isn't. It's been worn in, I guess, good enough so that it don't need to be double clutched. But I haven't driven it yet. Fact is, I was going to drive it about a week or so ago, and someone got the wrong oil in the brake lines, and the wheels froze up. So they're getting that cleaned out, and I guess they got it ready to go again, but I'll get to drive it yet. Maybe in a parade.
Yeah, maybe on VE Day or Memorial Day or Veterans Day.
That'll work.
That would be outstanding. Well, sir, I'm sure there's a lot that we didn't get to, and I'm sure you have a lot of stories that maybe even are too hard to tell, but I want to say thank you for serving our country, for sharing that story with us. And one more thing I'd like to ask you is, you think back about all of it. You think about the close calls, the fact that your children, grandchildren wouldn't be here if you didn't survive all that. What are you most proud of from your time in the military, and what would you say you're most thankful for at 91?
Well, actually, I'm thankful for still being alive, but I'm proud of the people that backed us up at home. You can go and fight a war, but unless you got backing back in the States, and by God, that was a real effort to do what they did, so we were able to do what we had to do. They deserve a big pat on the back, and I'm sure there's kiddos, young people, that'll remember aunts and uncles from World War II. And just say a little prayer for them, because they're the reason we're here today.
Amen. Well said. One more thing I want to hear about. Honor Flight. Our listeners have heard me talk a lot about this effort to get our World War II veterans to their memorial free of charge. And you got to have that experience with Northern New Mexico Honor Flight.
They treated us like we were royalty. And I got a little story. My daughter works at the Kirtland Air Force Base, and her boss is in Washington. And we were going around the monuments and all there, and he told my daughter that he wanted to meet me. They were pushing us in wheelchairs so we wouldn't hold up, you know. Some of us walk better than others. Anyhow, big black SUV comes up, and here's a major driving it. And this general gets out and walks over, and my daughter Linda says, hi. He came over, and he says, I salute you, Mr. Grasser. And I said, sir, you're saluting a PFC. And he said, well, this PFC is going to get it. I'm going to push his chair to the bus. And he did, and it was a thrill.
You think Patton would have done that for you?
You know, I saw Patton one time. And no, answer your question. But we're coming on a convoy, and we're bucking the traffic, going to the back. And this Jeep comes swinging up and comes to the intersection and spins around. And this guy stands up in the Jeep. And he's got the pantaloons on. Is that what you call the doggone things?
Oh, the jodhpurs.
Yeah. And his helmet was shined to a T. And I heard him say, the assistant driver, I heard him say, get these vehicles out of here so these wounded heroes can get through. And I poked the driver and says, hell, that's Patton. And he said, yeah. And that's, I don't know, I've heard he didn't mix words with. He looked like he was 10 foot tall, believe me. And he had the pistols on him, too.
The Pearl pistols.
Yes, sir.
Yep. With regard to the Honor Flight, when you got to the World War II Memorial, here, your whole job in World War II is to evacuate the wounded so they'll survive, so they don't add to that number. But that number is more than 406,000. And you get to that memorial, and you see the wall of gold stars that represents that. What was that like for you?
I tell you, you think about different instances when you're over there. It was a long time coming, and you think, thank God there are more of us alive, came back. And maybe because some little thing that each one of us doing their job helped to get it over with. And I thought about the living and the ones that had lived and come back that are gone now. Just regular people like myself gave their all, lived their lives, raised their family, and I'm very proud to have been one of them.
As well you should be, and we're proud to know you. Tom Grasser, 91 years old. And one final note. If you're listening on our affiliate KIVA, The Rock of Talk in Albuquerque, or on any of our other stations, maybe you can help here. The museum where I interviewed Tom Grasser is looking for a new permanent home. The nonprofit has lost its lease, and they're going to have to put the largest collection of military vehicles in all of New Mexico into storage. If you think you can help them find a new location, or maybe even just point them in the right direction, I have the information, the contact info for you at hometownheroesradio.com. It's really an incredible collection, and of course it led to the incredible connection we heard about today. Next time, we're going to meet the voice of a memorable cartoon character and hear his World War II story, but we're out of time for now. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.